Hello, everyone. My name is Rich Karlinski, and this is Young History, episode 147 on Ghana. The capitalist country is Accra, and normally we start these episodes out by explaining the etymology of the country's name, but this time we're going to acknowledge that later on as we actually do the country's history, because it's very relevant to a few different things. So with that, I'm just going to get right into the facts. Ghana is renowned for its vibrant and colorful kente cloth. This traditional woven fabric is often associated with the Akan people and is worn on special occasions, celebrations, and festivals. It is made by many different kinds of Akan women who have usually inherited this skill from their grandmother or mother who passed it down to them. And there's different symbols, color styles, patterns, all of that put into the kente cloth to attempt to tell a story of the Akan people or the person who purchased it slash owns it. Another thing is that the national football team in Ghana is known as the Black Stars. They have a strong footballing tradition and have participated in multiple FIFA World Cup tournaments. One of the most successful African nations in the tournament is Ghana. And now we're going to talk a little about cuisine. So some popular dishes include Yolof rice, Wakye, Banku with tilapia, and Fufu with a light soup. You can look into a few of these for yourself. Yolof rice is the most popular one. This whole West African region, Nigeria, Ghana, all that, make their own versions of Yolof rice. It's a big thing culturally to see who has the best one. And it's the thing that the whole world thanks them for. And this country's cuisine connects a lot of the old indigenous flavors with the influences of Europe and the different regions that make up a greater country. Ghana is known for its vibrant traditional festivals, each celebrated by different ethnic groups. Examples include the Hamowo Festival of the Ga people, the Obakir Festival of the Efutu, and the Adwira Festival of the Akan. And one thing that isn't a festival, but more of a ceremony celebration, is the naming ceremonies that are very significant in different parts of Ghana culture. Babies are often named on the eighth day after birth, and the ceremony involves rituals, prayers, and the selection of a meaningful name to connect this person to the future they may have. And among the Grobo people, the Dipo rite of passage ceremony actually marks the transition of young girls into womanhood. It's a very big celebration here when girls get their period for the first time. And it involves various rituals, teachings, dances, and the wearing of traditional kente cloth from other cultures. So it's a very unique way things are viewed here. There's a lot of different celebrations for things that aren't normally celebrated or aren't celebrate as much as they should be in different parts of the world. So Ghana is very, very significant culturally to this region and is also very significant historically. So we're just going to get right into it. I don't want to dilly-dally for too much longer, as I like to say. But with that being said, thank you guys for being here. I really hope you guys enjoy this one. This is, I don't know, I kind of have this thing in my head where I view certain countries as kind of like the final boss for each region. And Ghana is one of those, where Ghana has been so significant to so much of West Africa and so many things culturally, and they still are in that area they are, which is like West, moving into Central and East Africa. It's very unique. So I think Ghana is awesome. I've read a few books on it, and we're going to get right into it. So thank you guys so much for being here. My name is Rich Karlinski. This is Young History, and this is Ghana. I hope you guys enjoy. Our origins begin at an unconfirmed time when people formed into small groups after arriving in the land. The first people here are very hard to pin down, mainly for the fact that they were only hunter-gatherers and fishermen that left little to no actual trace of their existence behind. However, after time, we see the development of the Sangwan culture. The Sangwan culture is not specifically associated with Ghana, but Sangwan is a term used to describe a stone tool culture found in various parts of West Africa, but it did affect this area. This culture is characterized by distinctive large cutting tools associated with the Middle Stone Age. Then there was the Kantampo complex. The Kantampo complex in Ghana refers to an archaeological culture associated with the Middle Stone Age as well as the Sangwan. This culture is named after the Kantampo town of central Ghana because this is where significant archaeological findings of these peoples were made. And the Kantampo complex is known for its distinctive tool use, including bifacial points, scapers, and other artifacts that were used for different things than what the Sangwan were using it for. And from this point on to our next thing, there isn't a lot of change, at least that we can pin down. So we're going to jump into our next culture right around 1000 CE, which is the Dagbon people. They lived in northern parts of Ghana and then united the different tribes that made up the Dagbon and established a political and military entity right around that year, 1000 CE. It was called the Dagbon Kingdom. Dagbon was a significant political and cultural entity for centuries, with a complex system of chieftaincy and governance. Around that same time, the Akan people founded the Bonomon Kingdom in the state. And the Akan were specifically renowned for being part of that gold-rich region in southern Ghana, and this allowed them to advance pretty quickly because they traded internally to create a system of wealth in the area, and they were also the first people to start trading outside of the region. Now, the kingdom used gold mining and regional trade to build up their wealth, and this opened up even more doors for them to eventually trade with Europe and other great regions. European contact began in 1471, when the Portuguese explorers first made contact with the land and its people. Trade with the local peoples began, and the Portuguese found gold in no time. In just 11 years, a massive fortress was erected by the Portuguese. The fort was meant to protect Portuguese trade interests in the rich gold areas, because the Portuguese were starting to set up trade ports here. In 1492, a French vessel raided a Portuguese merchant fleet for the large amounts of gold it was carrying. The name, the Gold Coast, was given to the southern area controlled by the Akan. Gold Coast was quickly accepted as the term for this land across Europe by the 1600s. And also in that time was the Akwamu State. This state was formed around 1600 when many tribes of Akan people within the Bonomon broke away to form a new political unit. The people in the state became centralized and formed into smaller kingdoms that made up a greater Akwamu State. One of them was the Denkyira, who dominated gold mines and trade. This made them the richest and most powerful kingdom in the region, so they forced neighboring communities to pay tribute to them or risk being invaded. Kumasiman was one of those tributary kingdoms that formed in 1640. In the Kumasiman area, King Osetutu made plans to invade the oppressive Denkyira. The king enlisted the help of Anochi Akumbo, who was a spiritual leader. With Anochi was a handmade golden stool. The legend states that this golden stool was created by the founder of the Akan people and is meant to be a unity piece for all of them. People actually agreed with this idea and started to unite behind the idea that there was only one man at a time worthy of sitting upon this golden stool, because it is believed that the golden stool housed the ancestors of the people and that it was a place for powerful souls to be. And so if someone sat upon it, they had to be very, very worthy. And so these different Akan people groups started to form together to actually pick a person to sit upon this throne and establish the royal dynasty. So eventually, a confederation of local states emerged, and this became known as the Ashanti Confederation. In 1701, the Asante invaded the region dominated by the Denkyira Kingdom. The Denkyira force dominated the early battles because they had access to Dutch firearms, which they had gained through gold trade. But these were all part of the plan by Osetutu, who was the strong commander of the Ashanti forces. Tutu allowed his opponents to believe that they had pushed the Ashanti back so that he could launch a perfect ambush. The Ashanti emerged victorious and ended up establishing the Ashanti Empire. The empire was established with its capital at Kumasi. Between 1745 and 1765, the Ashanti expanded their rule across all of the Gold Coast, Togo, and neighboring lands to the north. The Ashanti came to dominate more and more of the region and ended up dominating anything to do with the trade of gold, ivory, and more. The Ashanti were a slave trading confederation. They became rich and powerful overlords by selling prisoners of war and political enemies to the Dutch, British, and Danish as slaves. For the vast trade of slaves that occurred in the Ashanti Empire, the entire army was armed with European firearms, making it the only army of this time to be armed head to toe with firearms from Europe, as opposed to just certain groups having them. And just for distinction purposes, as we go through this, I'm going to say Gold Coast, and then I'm going to say Northern Territories, and then I'm going to say Togo. So Togo is an individual independent country now, and is also eventually interacts with the Europeans the same way as the Ashanti do. Then there's the Ashanti region. There's the Gold Coast region, which is both south of the Ashanti and is the greater southern region because it's the coast where gold was sold. And then there's the Northern Territories, which is just a bunch of different tribes, clans, and kingdoms all together that are always seen as controlled by the Ashanti. And then back into things with what the Ashanti were doing, the king of the Ashanti was known as Asantehene, who was named ruler by sitting upon their legendary golden stool. In the late 1700s, the Ashanti people sought to expand east and were challenged by the Fon kingdom of Dahomey. Dahomey is the indigenous term for what we call today Benin. The Fon people had an especially deadly force of female fighters that made up the upper echelon of the Dahomey army. Despite the effectiveness of this female-led special operations group, the Ashanti were far too powerful in both number and technology to be defeated. So eventually, this was also incorporated into the Ashanti region. In the southern part of the same Ashanti region was the Achiem. The region rose up to resist Ashanti rule after it had continued to expand it and apply more pressure to its tributary states. The Achiem formed an alliance with Tenkfon in Dahomey and the Yoruba kingdom in Oyo. Both of the latter nations occupied present-day Benin and Togo. In 1764, the Triple Alliance of the Achiem, Dahomey, and Oyo invaded the eastern border of the Ashanti and delivered them an embarrassing and unexpected defeat. This sent the Ashanti into a frenzy. The citizens of the empire overthrew their ruler and sought to create a new system that would better defend the nation and maintain dominance in the area. Osei Kwaidyo was brought in as leader. He sat upon the golden stool and the Ashanti hailed him as the king. He reigned from 1764 to 1777 and gained a lot of popularity for his efforts to be unlike the former leader. Kwaidyo wanted to bring the Ashanti Empire back to its days of dominance and control. The power of the Ashanti was challenged by the local Fante people who didn't want to end up full subjects of the Ashanti, and this ended up brewing fully into the Ashanti-Fante War. The war was fought from 1806 to 1824. The Ashanti won the war very handedly and expanded their control over every single Fante state. The expansion of the Ashanti prevented the spread of British influence and trade. The domination by the Ashanti brought them into conflict with the British because now the Ashanti were not only standing in the way of trade, but they refused to allow the British to continue to expand their influence or push trade north through the Ashanti Confederation. By 1820, the British and Dutch had outlawed the Atlantic slave trade, and this ended up weakening the Ashanti economy and created tensions between the British and the Ashanti once again. Eventually, the tensions rose over the next few years, and the first British-Ashanti War started in 1864. By this point, the Ashanti were very used to warfare, and specifically employing tactics of war in their region. So they were actually able to defeat the British in this war. But the battles with the British were far from over. In the wake of the first British-Ashanti War, traveler and analyst Thomas Bowdish explored the Ashanti Empire and brought back what to the Europeans was shocking news. Bowdish described that the Ashanti were extremely advanced in technology, political systems, education, and in civil rights. There was also a vast hieroglyphic system called the Adinkra. This was a way for different people to communicate and to tell stories of the Ashanti. In the 1850s, Britain battled against the Dutch for domination of influence and trade in the region. And by the end of the 1850s, the Dutch had pretty much packed their stuff and left the area. In 1870, all of them were gone, and Britain was the premier European power left in the region. The dominant presence of England led to the Second Anglo-Ashanti War. It was fought from 1863 to 1864. The conflict, according to the British, was triggered by the fact that the Ashanti expanded south into their occupied region of the Gold Coast. The British were able to recapture major cities in the south and partition for peace against the Ashanti. However, the resistance against British presence was far from over. The Third Anglo-Ashanti War was fought from 1873 to 1874. The British marched into the heart of the Ashanti Empire. Battles occurred between both powers, and there was a lot of realization on both sides. The British were finally able to understand how grandiose, advanced, and sophisticated the Ashanti were. Not because of the fact that they were tasting defeat, but because of the fact that they were seeing widespread organization, hierarchy of rulers, and they also saw the beautiful, well-made structures of the Ashanti Empire. However, the Ashanti also realized the power of British steel, and they felt this more than anywhere else when machine guns were deployed for the first time on the Ashanti battlefield. Towards the end of the war, the British invaded the capital city Kumasi and burned it to the ground. Throughout 1874, the British officially created the Gold Coast Colony. This was meant to take up the southern part of the region, which occupied both Ashanti land and the Gold Coast itself. So the Gold Coast kind of surrounds and encapsulates the Ashanti, but we still have left Togoland in the east, and then north was the northern territories of different kingdoms. Over the next few years, there was many protests against British rule and against the way the Ashanti allowed the British to enter the land. The divisions of the Ashanti, paired with the resistance of those living in the northern territories, caused the Ashanti to be unable to create a united front when the British came to fight again. So, the Fourth Anglo-Ashanti War began. The British offered official protectorate status to the Ashanti king, but it was rejected by him and his cabinet. The British took this as a sign of disrespect and marched into the area to start another invasion. Battles went back and forth, but in the end, the British were able to overrun the Ashanti and force them into protectorate status either way. Ya Asantewaa was a warrior queen of the Ashanti kingdom who wanted to defend the traditional values of the Ashanti. She directly led the resistance movement against the British because the British decided that they wanted the golden stool befitting a king for themselves. The idea that a white European foreigner would sit upon the golden stool of the Ashanti created a deep resentment against British presence in the area. The resistance movement turned violent when the British started to crack down on it and proper conflict broke out. This was the War of the Golden Stool. It began in the year 1900 and was settled in the same year. Both sides fought valiantly, but the pride of the Ashanti people was on the line, so they vowed to never give up until they drew their last breath. The Ashanti were able to fully defend the stool from being captured, and it is actually still a preserved object in Ghana today. It can be observed in the Archaeological Museum of Ghana. So in 1901, after negotiations from the war had concluded, the Ashanti kingdom was officially declared a British crown colony. The northern people, groups, and clans in the Gold Coast would be administered through the Ashanti Crown Colony. All of this would take effect on the 1st of January in 1902. British rule brought the introduction of Christianity, the British-style teaching system, the expansion of the English language, and British medical care systems. The British also introduced new technologies such as advanced railroads to connect the coast to the inland. The British also banned the ancient Akan practice of human sacrifice. Britain also heavily expanded the planting of cocoa beans, and Ghana quickly became one of the largest producers globally for the product. In 1935, the Ashanti Kingdom was reestablished. This time, it was as a subnational kingdom within the country of the Gold Coast. It still exists to this day on a subnational level, but is recognized as its own de facto state. And as British rule rolls on, we see the rise of one man who wants to stand against it, Kwame Nkrumah. He was instrumental in the creation and development of the United Gold Coast Convention, or UGCC. Which was a political unit that sought to advocate for self-rule. To go more deep on Nkrumah, he was a politician that rose through the ranks by competing in different small areas of the Gold Coast, and then eventually rose up to the political national level when he started to advocate for this idea of self-rule and independence because everyone agreed with him. Of course, everyone's an exaggeration, but he gained lots of popularity because this vast majority of people felt that he was putting into words the sentiments they felt in their heart. In 1946, the UGCC gained the right to have an African majority in the National Assembly. In 1947, Nkrumah returned to the nation after spending 12 years studying politics abroad. With this new experience, he gained an executive role in the United Gold Coast Convention. Throughout 1948, Nkrumah expanded his efforts for the movement towards self-rule. This ended up facing a lot of resistance and protests. Nkrumah was blamed for these protests starting and was arrested alongside some of his political allies in the UGC by the British colonial government. In 1950, Nkrumah organized and led nonviolent protests against colonial rule, and once again, he was jailed. From 1951 to 1952, the UGCC won Gold Coast's first free election, and Nkrumah was released from prison to become the Prime Minister of the nation. Both the UGCC and Nkrumah won, and it was because of the dominance of their elections that there was a huge support for how these two separate things would operate, both the entity of the UGCC and the man Nkrumah. With this newfound support, Nkrumah and the UGCC did everything they could to push for independence. They gained self-rule, they gained more autonomy, started to show more and more how well they were on their own, and then a referendum started to come out about independence. Now, the path to independence for the neighboring nation of Togoland, which was also a British colony, was not as well carved out as it was for the Gold Coast. So a referendum went out in 1956 that saw the citizens of Togoland vote to gain independence alongside the Gold Coast. And then speaking of independence, it officially came in 1957, because the Gold Coast, the Ashanti, the Northern Territories, and Togoland all voted to become one independent country away from all colonial influence. This made the new nation of Ghana the first country in all of Africa to declare independence from colonial rule. Nkrumah was a staunch advocate of Pan-Africanism, and he promoted unity and cooperation among African nations. He showed this by having so many different people groups in his country at the start of its birth. Nkrumah hosted the first Conference of Independent African States in 1958 and played a key role in the formation of the Organization of African Unity in 1963. And now I want to talk about the Ghana namesake. Why is this country called Ghana? Around 300 BC, the Sahara experienced a drier-than-usual period, which drove the Sonike people south. The Soninke people originally lived near the region of modern-day Mauritania, and they moved down to a more fertile area from the Niger River. Between 200 BC and 200 CE, the Soninke people merged with other people groups to form an early civilization which became the Ghana Empire. The Ghana Kingdom, which is what it was before it grew into an empire, was headed by the Ghanata as the kingly ruler. The name Ghanata, or Ghana, would eventually be used to describe not only the king, but the entire region under his rule. So, this is why we refer to the entire entity as Ghana Empire today. By 300 CE, the Ghana Kingdom had expanded across a significant amount of West Africa. The Ghana Kingdom clashed with the Gao Kingdom near Burkina Faso. The expansion was followed by a wetter season in the region, which allowed for more crop growth and directly led to a population growth. From the 700s to the 1000s, Ghana exported more and became the most powerful empire in the region. The dynastic Almoravid Empire from Morocco expanded south and took trade cities from Ghana from 1062 to 1076. Ghana and the Almoravid dynasty fought a nasty war that spread the Ghana Empire thin. In 1076, the Almoravids invaded the empire's capital, Koumbi, and subjugated its power. The fall of the capital allowed for full Almoravid influence to take over the nation. The empire was converted to Islam in 1076. In 1087, the legendary Almoravid leader Abu Bakr died, and the dynastic chaos that followed split the Ghana Empire into many parts. In the decades that followed, the Ghana kingdoms would dissolve or be absorbed into larger political entities. And as you could probably grab from the description of this, this was not an empire that reigned over the region of Ghana today. It was actually in more northwest Africa, where you see Mauritania, Senegal, the Gambia, and Mali. The Ghana Empire was one of the most powerful political units to ever touch the continent, and the domination of trade, art, military, and culture actually inspired Nkrumah and the people of what was at the time the Gold Coast to adopt the name of their nation upon independence because they felt it was powerful despite its distance. So that's why Ghana is Ghana today, and it isn't some country in Northwest Africa. It's this West African nation that we know today. And now we can get back on track with the Nkrumah presidency. In 1960, Ghana became a republic with Nkrumah as the president. And not just any president, he was named president for life. The convention was repurposed to become the Convention People's Party, or CPP. Nkrumah pursued an ambitious economic development agenda, focused on industrialization and infrastructure projects. The largest project was the hydroelectric dam. This project led to the creation of the Akosombo Dam. It took a lot for this dam to be built because it required Ghana sacrificing 3% of the nation's total territory to create the first lake from the Upper Volta, so from the Volta River. So the Volta River is a very significant river that divides west to east many nations in West Africa, and it has a bunch of river deltas but has no lakes. Nkrumah and his men actually dammed the river deltas so that a lake would be formed, but this caused around 3% of Ghana to be flooded, as I was saying before. The reason they did this was not only for the sake of getting access to water, but it was two other things. One was aluminum. In order to harvest the huge amount of bauxite in Ghana, which is huge across West Africa, and change it into aluminum, they needed a lot of electricity, which they did not have access to beforehand. This is another thing that's also popular in sub-Saharan Africa, is the lack of access to electricity. Then, from here, there was also the fact that electricity for the people itself could be gained from this dam. Now, the dam was extremely expensive, and half of it was paid for by Ghana and its people, and then the second half was paid for by Europe and other investors. But the thing was, these investors would only invest in this dam if it meant that 80% of the generated electricity would go towards turning bauxite into aluminum, and only 20% would be allocated for the people. Now, this 20% allocated to the people still put Ghana at a way higher percentage than almost anywhere else in sub-Saharan Africa, and by the end of the building of the dam, more and more of said power was actually expanded to the people, and the creation of the Akosombo Dam marked a lot of huge things in history. So this was the creation of the first Volta Lake. There was no other lake coming from the Volta River, as we said before. And then there was also the fact that, and this Volta Lake actually became the largest man-made lake in the entire world. It is twice the size of Rhode Island, the state in the United States. It takes up over 3% of the entire nation of Ghana. It's large, very, very large. And the biggest achievement was also this. Ghana is one of only 5 nations in sub-Saharan Africa that has access to electricity for over 85% of its people. The only other nations that have that are South Africa, Eswatini, and a few other ones like Gabon, because most sub-Saharan African nations have a whole lot of history to delve through to understand the inequality, but it ends up equaling out to no electricity. But that's not true with the Arab nations in the north, like Libya, Algeria, and Egypt. So this ends up being a huge mega project, but it does change the course of history for Ghana forever. But there is also a dark side to this, because power outages are a huge issue in Ghana. Major, actually. Most people end up experiencing maybe a third of their time without power because of the fact that sanctioned power outages happen so that electricity can be exported to other nations like Benin and Togo. And Nkrumah was an extremely influential president. He attempted to bring Marxist ideas in, so he brought social programs and socialism in the idea of healthcare for all the people, distribution of money, more rights, more safety nets for his people. But eventually, the economic challenges started to rise. The cost of megaprojects like the Akasombo Dam mounted with the need for social programs because of Ghana's growing population. So towards the end of Nkrumah's presidency, Ghana faced heavy economic inequality that widened the gap between those living in rural and urban parts of the country. In the midst of all the mounting struggles within Ghana, Nkrumah went on a trip to China to discuss Marxist communist ideals. While he was there, a coup ousted him and placed a new government in power. Nkrumah was exiled to Guinea. Since the exile in Nkrumah, there has been very little done to expand the electricity of the nation or reoptimize the way the Akasombo Dam gives power to its people. So after Nkrumah was ousted, there was the general election of 1969. It officially created the Republic of Ghana and elected Kofi Busia as president. Busia was an open and vibrant opponent of the way that Nkrumah had run the country before him. So once Nkrumah was ousted, Busia seemed like the clear-cut choice to lead the nation. Busia's presidency was characterized by attempts to address economic challenges, promote private enterprise, and implement educational reforms. However, his government faced criticism for some of its policies, and there were tensions within the country. Despite many efforts, Busia was unable to fix the struggling economy of Ghana. The economic struggle in Ghana was heavily exacerbated by the fact that cocoa prices continued to drop. Throughout this entire period, cocoa remained the major agricultural export of Ghana. The lack of genuine success in changing the economic standing of Ghana was the downfall of the Busia presidency. In January 1972, Busia's government was overthrown in a military coup led by Colonel Ignatius Akyempong, marking the end of the Second Republic. Following the coup, Ghana entered a period of military rule that lasted until 1979. Kofi Busia went into exile but later returned to Ghana, where he continued to be involved in academia until his death in 1978. Ignatius Akyempong and Frederick Afufo were the two military commanders that led the coup, and also they were the ones who took power in the nation during the military period. In this period, party politics were banned in hopes to eliminate political polarization. But then there was Jerry Rawlings. Rawlings was a lieutenant in the Air Force, so he had a support from the military that did not support the junta in power. He led a coup in 1979 against the military government due to the lack of progress the country faced. Rawlings established the Provisional National Defense Council, PNDC, as the transitionary body of the government. The period of military rule is also known as the Third Republic of Ghana. But the Third Republic lasted for only 2 years. Rawlings also had support because he promised that there would be speedy elections to reestablish an organized government. There was a lot of international pressure that mounted with the call of the Fourth Republic to be declared. In the 1992 elections, the Fourth Republic was declared official. A national referendum saw 92% of voters support the proposals made by PNDC. In the same year, the previous ban on party politics was removed so that free and fair elections could occur between multiple political parties. The elections occurred and saw the National Democratic Congress win a vast majority of parliamentary seats. The National Democratic Congress, or NDC, was the rebranded Provisional National Defense Council that had combined with its supporters. The constitution that was written and proposed in 1992 became the basis for the Fourth Republic of Ghana being established with a strong system to back it. In the same period, Rawlings stepped down as the military ruler, stood for presidential elections as the candidate for the NDC, and won elections to become the president of the new Fourth Republic. The Rawlings presidency was focused on the expansion of national ideals, and Rawlings expanded the nation to become a free market economy. He then expanded privatization, expanded economic sectors, and limited the amount of money the government could spend. The 1996 elections were entirely rejected by the opposition, despite the international courts ruling them as free and fair. These elections saw Rawlings retain the presidency. He served as president until 2001 after winning these elections. During his Democratic presidency, in the second term, Rawlings continued to double down on social reform, but he did face a lot of criticism for human rights abuses, which were based in the fact that there was media censorship and the suppression of political opposition, which may have been very violent. Rawlings ended his presidency by declaring that he would not run for re-election in 2000. It would be the 2000 elections that John Kufuor became president as leader of the New Patriotic Party. In 2001, its centennial year, of the Nobel Committee, 2001, the Peace Prize was actually divided between the UN and Kofi Annan. These two were awarded the Peace Prize for their work for a better organized and more peaceful world. This was based on the fact that the UN itself was led through Ghana, specifically Kofi Annan, to focus more on emphasizing peace, stability, and health of individual people within a greater nation of nations that were in the United Nations. I know that was a mouthful, but you get what I mean. John Kufuor, as president, had one of the most successful presidential runs of most African nations in the 2000s. In 2003, there was a health insurance change. Kufuor introduced the National Health Insurance Scheme, NHIS, to enhance healthcare accessibility for risk protection against the cost of basic healthcare services. To make the health insurance system more inclusive, the government under President Kufuor introduced premium subsidies for certain vulnerable groups such as the poor, elderly, and sick children. This was aimed at ensuring that these groups could also benefit from the expanding NHIS. Kufuor won the presidential election of 2004 to start his second term. His presidency is often associated with positive economic growth. Kufuor's government implemented the compulsory universal basic education policy, which aims to provide free and compulsory basic education for all Ghanaian children. This initiative was part of efforts to improve the education sector. In 2005, the Ghana School Feeding Program was rolled out. The program hoped to give one more hot meal a day to elementary-age school children in poor areas of Ghana. Even though there was issues with the way the food was distributed, this nonetheless helped contribute hot, free meals to kids in this country. So it was successful in my book. In 2008, the Kufuor presidency ended. The National Democratic Congress listed Arthur Mills as the candidate for the next election. John Arthur Mills won the 2008 election to become president, and during his presidency, Ghana began commercial oil production. The Jubilee oil field, discovered in 2007, started production in December of 2010, contributing heavily to the country's economic growth. Mills' presidency emphasized social policies, poverty reduction, and economic development through oil trade. His administration implemented various social intervention programs to address the needs of less privileged people in society. Unfortunately, President Mills' time in office was cut short by a sudden death on July 4, 2012. He passed away at the age of 68. Vice President John Dramani Mahama succeeded him and completed his term. John Dramani Mahama, in the 2012 presidential election, contested the candidate for National DRC for the National Democratic Congress and won, which secured him a full term as president. Mahama's presidency faced many economic challenges, including high inflation, budget deficits, and a depreciation of the Ghana cedi, which is the currency. Despite this, Mahama did initiate the Better Ghana Agenda, which was a major policy aimed at enhancing living standards for anyone in Ghana. But in the 2016 presidential election, Nana Akufo-Addo actually defeated Mahama to become president. In his first term, Akufo focused on several initiatives, including the free senior high school program. This aimed at providing free education at the secondary level to seniors. Other areas of focus included industrialization, agriculture, and hopes to stabilize the economy. But in his second term, which began in 2020, there was a large economic crisis. In 2022, it hit its worst because of the fact that there was a lack of capital flowing through the country, the value of the currency was depreciating, and the banks were starting to fail because of high unemployment rates. And all this was also exacerbated by the fact that Ghana struggled to recover from COVID-19. So, ever since the Nkrumah presidency, economic struggles have gripped Ghana very heavily. And it's been the main thing keeping them from advancing into better areas. Because even though this country is very democratic and very stable compared to its neighbors, it does still struggle very heavily with economy and different things that would make this nation a freer, fairer, better place to live. So with all that being said, that gets us to the present, where Ghana has a medium level of human development on the Human Development Index. Ghana was also ranked as one of the most politically free nations on the African continent, especially among those in sub-Saharan Africa. However, it is not all sunshine and rainbows in this country. People living in rural areas have a significant lack of access to resources, including electricity, food, and water. The economy of Ghana is in a very rough place. That crisis in 2022 and the earlier economic struggles have made it very hard for people not in the upper middle class or higher to get by day to day in Ghana. Ghana is also a world leader in cacao bean production to this day, but the people who grow it and harvest it tend to be a part of the poorest communities in Ghana. This is due to the fact that British and European companies still have their giant corporations there, which employ Ghanaian people to work and pick up the soil and pick up the cocoa beans, but they aren't actually the ones who get money for it. So there's actually been a movement to kind of renationalize the Ghana cocoa industry and bring money back to the people and take it away from these giant British corporations and stuff, but it still struggles because of the fact that these corporations are extremely rich. But nonetheless, Ghana is a cornerstone of African culture and is the hub of West African operations. The history of the people here, along with their culture, defines the nation and the perspective and the perseverance of the people who have called this place their home for generations. With hope, Ghana will continue down a path of growth and development and will be able to solve the issues that have plagued it for centuries. And that brings us to the end. And that gets us to the end where I would like to do a takeaway or mindset with the history we did. And today, doing the history of Ghana, I have only one takeaway for you guys. Embrace fully who you are. And I mean that with as much specificness you want to give it. For some people, it's I am this job, I am this role in life, husband, father, whatever. For some people, it's hobbies. For some people, it's different things. This can mean anything to you. To the Ghana citizens and its history, there's been the Ashanti, the different peoples, the presidents, and Nkrumah. All of those people fully embody what it means to be fully who you are and embrace it fully and live it fully, because these are prideful, hardworking people that have changed the course of their history through their work, being the first nation on the African continent to break away from colonial rule. Now, I truly hope that you are able to never suffer like they have suffered. For you, it can be something else. Whatever that sacrifice is, whatever you have to do, it's going to end up equaling being yourself. And it's hard to stay on that path. It's hard to not fully embrace who you are, stand up for who you are. But whatever it is, embrace it. Whatever your passion is, whatever your drive is, your goal, go get it. Because the only thing stopping you is you, and the judgment of other people doesn't matter. And this country and its people has shown us that over and over and over again. So, full-heartedly, you got this. Be full yourself and be like the people of Ghana. And that's going to be all for me, guys. I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. Ghana is a cornerstone of civilization in West Africa, and I love it with all my heart. So just going to sign off now and say one more time, my name is Reese Karlinski. This is Young History, and that was Ghana. I hope you guys enjoyed.